From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The Battle at Bunker Hill was the first major military fight in the American Revolution. But for the residents of Boston at the time, no one realized it would turn out to be a point of no return. In Boston, you had your diehard patriots and those loyal to the British crown, but most of those in the city at the time weren't sure really where they stood. That is, until a gang of men tossed boxes of surplus tea into the Boston Harbor. The historian Nathaniel Philbrick says what makes a revolution such a fascinating subject to study is the arrival of this moment when neutrality is no longer an option. That's what happened in Boston. Philbrick is joining us today in the program to talk about his latest book called Bunker Hill, about this moment in history that he calls the critical turning point in the story of America. After the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We've all heard about the Battle of Bunker Hill in grade school. It's a story that takes in the midnight ride of Paul Revere, of the command not to shoot until you see the whites of their eyes. It's the first major battle of the American Revolution, but not many living in Boston at the time were expecting that. The battle began as a rebellion in the streets of the city, and even though the hostilities between American patriots and the British were heating up, most people weren't sure where they stood. The historian and writer Nathaniel Philbrick has written a book about the fight at Bunker Hill. Turns out it wasn't actually Bunker Hill where it took place. We'll get to that. But it was a turning point where a rebellion turned into an all-out war where people were forced to pick a side. And the story isn't just about one battle. This one plays out over some 18 months where Boston was occupied by British troops. Philbrick says it transformed that city and the towns around it. And his book is about that transformation and how it influenced what became the United States. Today in the program, Nathaniel Philbrick is joining us to talk about his book. It's called Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. Nathaniel Philbrick is an historian and author. Among his books are In the Heart of the Sea, which won the National Book Award for nonfiction, and Mayflower, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. He's joining us today from his home on Nantucket Island. He joins us from a studio there at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation. And Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Well, it's great to be with you again.
Well, I guess I wanted to begin with, of all the kind of crucial moments in the American Revolution, what got you thinking about the Battle of Bunker Hill? What first got you thinking about this particular battle, this particular story?
Well, you know, for me, it goes way back, actually fifth grade, when I first read Johnny Tremaine.
Yeah.
And for me, that was like, wow, history is not just old statues and dusty artifacts. It's kids just like me in the middle of extraordinary events. And it wasn't until I moved to Boston in 1985, my wife and I lived there in the North End, which is really the historic center of Boston to this day, and I began to think, you know, what was it like in the time of Johnny Tremaine? And eventually it resulted in this book.
One of the things that you struggled with in writing this, you've talked about, was trying to get a fix, as you put it in the book, on the topography of Boston at the time, because,
yeah.
I mean, the place has changed incredibly.
Oh, it's unrecognizable now. You know, you drive into Boston, you're surrounded by urban sprawl. And what you don't realize necessarily is that the neighborhoods of Boston, for example, the Back Bay, was actually a bay, the Back Bay. Water lapped up along the edge of Boston Common. And so Boston was a 1.2 square mile island with just a thin neck of land connecting it to the mainland at the town of Roxbury, dominated by three hills of almost mountainous proportions, with two neighborhoods, the North and the South End, jammed in there between those hills and 50 or more wharves. And Boston was a very isolated outpost in the colonies.
Yeah. I mean, you have to put away your idea of Boston in the 21st century, really, to kind of get this story. Because you have to think of it as a small town, 15,000 people, you say, and all of whom probably recognized, if not knew, each other.
Yeah. The one thing I began to realize is how personal this all was. Yeah. What you believed, whether you were a loyalist or a patriot, depended a lot on who you knew, who you disliked, who you liked, what your job was, and what side of the bread was buttered, so to speak. And so, yeah, this was people at this time knew each other, if not by name, visually. And so what was going on was really an interplay of a community as much as it was a working out of ideological issues.
There's this epigraph at the beginning of the first chapter, one anyway, here, that it's from the diary of John Adams, where he writes about how, as he puts it, resentment is a natural passion, and how, as he says, men have this duty to indulge and cultivate the sense of resentment. And I was thinking about it later. I mean, this seems to be in some ways a perfect way of illustrating the New England point of view at the time, which is different from other colonies, it seems.
Yeah, New Englanders from the beginning, their origins in 1630 when the first Puritans came over, they were intent on doing it their own way. Yeah. Their ancestors had moved to New England so that they could be beyond the reach of the king and his ministers, so they could worship as they wanted to. And so from the beginning, they saw themselves as an autonomous enclave, what John Winthrop described as a city on the hill. And so 150 years later, when the passions that would erupt into the revolution came to the fore, these were people who looked at themselves as on their own. Their ancestors had come over and made a way of life for themselves. And now Great Britain, that really hadn't contributed much 100 years before when they really needed them, wanted to tax them. And so there was a lot of unfinished business from the 17th century that was feeding into what was going on in the 18th when the revolution began to break out in Boston.
And we should also explain, as you do in the book, they were used to being left alone. I mean, Britain didn't really have much to say in big ways, at least not for a good part of their history.
Yeah, and this is kind of the irony of the story. Up until a decade or so before, a policy of what became known as salutary neglect reigned, in which Great Britain did leave New England to do pretty much as it pleased. And as a result, they were the freest, least taxed members of the British Empire. This did not prevent them from complaining when Great Britain did decide to tax them a little bit. And that was inspired by the fact that Great Britain had fought the French and Indian War, which had ended in 1763, to the benefit of New England, defeating the French to the north, which had been harassing the New England colonies for more than a century, but putting Great Britain in debt by more than $20 billion, and today it's been estimated. And so Great Britain was looking ahead, trying to modernize itself and say, okay, we've got to make our colonies pay for their upkeep. The New Englanders were saying, no, we liked it the way it was.
Right.
And how dare you drag us kicking and screaming into the future?
I guess if you think about it, this is interesting. And one of the things I liked a lot about the book was that it really becomes apparent that some of the conventional wisdom that we've had about this relationship between Boston and Britain is kind of shaky. I mean, we'll talk about this in more detail, but on one hand, as you say in the book, Great Britain didn't really seem to have this plan to enslave the colonists and impose their will. And you mentioned this debt that they have, of course. And in some ways, it almost makes England sound this sounds terrible, maybe, but kind of reasonable, and the colonists in Boston a little petulant and a little irrational at times.
Well, that's definitely how the loyalists and Great Britain saw it.
Right.
They said, wait a minute, we're not trying to enslave you. We're just trying to make it so that you pay for your upkeep. But the question as far as the New Englanders was concerned, well, we want to be able to determine how we pay. We do not want Parliament dictating how we're going to do it. And so at issue was, does Parliament have sovereignty over its colonies? And unfortunately for England, they would push it, and gradually push all those people in the middle in New England and the other colonies who really didn't care about any of these issues, but gradually push them to choose a side, and with most of them going to the radical patriot side. And so, you know, this is, in the beginning, no one, not even the most radical of the patriots, such as Samuel Adams, saw independence as an inevitability.
Yeah.
They were just simply talking about issues of representation. And so what you see is it wasn't as black and white as I think many of us were taught to believe in elementary school and beyond. There was a huge amount of ambivalence within the colony. And that's been written out of the story, I think.
The tax that Britain has in mind to take care of part of this debt, this $22 billion debt, is the Tea Act, in part anyway. A tiny tax, you point out, in the scheme of things, something like 3 pence per pound. And your telling of the Tea Party story is really interesting. There's a great scene. Thousands of people had gathered at this old South meeting house in Boston. This is the winter of 1773. It's December. And like New Englanders are, they wanted a say in the matter. They wanted to have something to say about these three ships that were in the harbor. And in these ships, of course, was all of the surplus tea. You write about Josiah Quincy. He's one of the great characters you write about. Talk about Josiah Quincy and about this particular moment. It's really interesting.
Yeah, well, you know, this book has many characters that we don't think of when we think of the revolution in Boston, and Josiah Quincy is one of them. He was a young, very articulate lawyer in his early 30s, cross-eyed.
Right.
You know, there was an unsettling visual quality about him, but he was recognized as the most articulate of lawyers, and there are a lot of articulate lawyers in a town that included John Adams. Mm-hmm. And he stood before this crowd of 5,000 gathered in the Old South meeting, and in almost biblical prose, began to say, look, I'm not here on this earth for very long. He had tuberculosis, and right. Everyone knew he was not going to last much longer. He said, my time is short, but I can see that this decision may push England into confronting us, and what will result will be something much more horrendous and traumatic than any of us are currently anticipating. Yeah. And he said this in very passionate way, and to the point where an older resident, a loyalist, got up and accused him of treason.
Right.
But it set the tone that, you know, this was, it's almost apocalyptic rhetoric. And, you know, and in many ways, it reaches back to their Puritan ancestors, where what's happening on Earth is a reflection of the great forces of the universe. And Boston was, at that point, the epicenter of it.
You know, you get a sense that, you mentioned that no one really at that time knew, had a sense of what Josiah Quincy seemed to be saying, is, look, guys, there could be something here that's bigger than just some minor rebellion. Something could really come of this. But it's also, you get a sense that there's this kind of foreboding in some ways. I mean, you write about, for example, that in, I think it was 1770, there was this comet. Mm-hmm. Of course, there's the Boston Massacre that happens this year. And you get a sense that there is some kind of I don't know, foreboding is the word that kept coming to me. Maybe it was even the word that you used. But they knew something was changing. At least they had some sense of it, do you think?
Yeah, they did. And you know, what's interesting is it's actually the loyalists who see the writing on the wall,
yeah.
saying, you know, all these complaints that you have, if you take them to the where they lead naturally, logically, they lead to independence. And the Patriots said, no, that's not what we mean by any of this.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter was they were pushing for a position the implications of which they weren't really willing to face. And as a consequence, you see some of these leading patriots, John Adams, one of them, who have real psychological issues associated with their stand. They're so conflicted. You know, they want one thing, they're angry, and yet they can't admit to themselves that this might mean independence.
Right.
And John Adams had a breakdown shortly after defending the soldiers associated with the Boston Massacre, and there are other leaders who had similar issues. And there was an almost molecular change occurring among the Bostonians and throughout Massachusetts, really, as people were, you know, not quite sure where this was leading, and yet something they could feel, something traumatic and bad there. And it's fascinating to watch that as finally the realization comes quite late with Tom Paine's Common Sense that, whoa, maybe this does lead us into the creation of a new nation.
So let's go back to that winter evening in 1773, and Josiah Quincy is speaking eloquently, beautifully, as you say, but as he's speaking, men disguised as Indians can be seen through the meeting house windows headed toward that harbor.
I mean, it's very traumatic where it's night has come on. This is in December of 1773, and it's been raining, and the rain stops, and about 100 people disguised as Indians can be seen making their way down to the wharf, Griffin's Wharf, where those three tea ships are waiting, and that night will unfold the Boston Tea Party, and it's the event that really it's the event that begins my book and really sets into play all those forces that will ultimately result in a Revolutionary War.
Your telling of the Tea Party is interesting. I hadn't realized the tide was out. So they were basically throwing this tea not into water, or maybe a little bit of water, but into mud flats, really.
Mud flats. And, you know, and for me, it's kind of a metaphor for the history. You know, we have just such a tendency to see things in black and white and terms that are so concrete that they miss the complexities and the always much more interesting reality of what happened. You know, they didn't just throw the tea into Boston Harbor. The tide was out. So the tea landed on the mud flats. They even dispatched some young kids to spread it around so that when the tide did come up, it would float away and no one could steal some. And, you know, and that's kind of in miniature what was going on with this. There was no program at the beginning. They didn't wait for the tide to be up to throw out the tea. They threw out the tea and there it was. And this kind of thing would happen again and again, where they were headed in a direction that no one saw. You know, we look back now and see it all leading to the creation of the United States of America, but they didn't see it that way. They were still seeing it in very conservative terms. They were defending what they had always had rather than thinking in terms of creating something new.
Mm. The colonists knew this Tea Party thing was not going to go over well. I mean, it seemed like you get these stories throughout almost where these things will happen. We'll talk about some violence that occurs, this tarring and feathering, which is a really extraordinary story too. But it seems like these things sort of erupt, and they don't rethink them. They don't regret them necessarily. But I think there's some sense among the leaders that maybe we went a little bit too far. I get a sense that was the case in some way for the Tea Party, or at least there's some attempt to try to channel all of this this exuberance, all of this defiance.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the Patriot leaders had learned a lesson with the Boston Massacre, where things got out of control, people died, and it was messy and did not necessarily reflect well on the Patriot movement. It was perceived in England as sort of a mass uprising of a mob rather than an ideological discussion.
Yeah.
And so there was a big attempt with the Boston Tea Party to make it an act that was clearly to prove a point, something that was carefully orchestrated rather than something that was a mob unleashing uncontrolled violence.
Yeah.
And so there was an attempt to sort of hold the lid down after the Tea Party to show that this was an expression of a political stance rather than an unbridled upwelling of violence. And the problem is that, you know, events don't always go as scripted.
Right. Talk about Joyce Jr.
Yeah. Well, you know, just within a month of the Boston Tea Party, broadsides began to appear throughout the town, in which kind of a pre-revolutionary version of a superhero was announced. He called himself Joyce Jr., as in referring to a officer in Cromwell's army known as Joyce, who was responsible for capturing the king and reputedly was present when he was beheaded. Right. And so by calling himself Joyce Jr., this was a guy who was proclaiming him, you know, he was equating himself with a regicide. He was a patriot with a vengeance. And he also provided himself with a title as chairman of the Committee for Tarring and Feathering. And in these broadsides, he said that if any of the loyalists associated with the selling of this British tea dared to return to Boston, he would make sure they suffered the dignity of a tarring and feathering. And you know, he was clearly making it, you know, it's kind of a vigilante meets a mysterious hero, and he's described. He would make appearances after this, and he'd wear a wig and a mask and a cape, and you know, so he was almost had this kind of Batman aspect to him, right. And he, you know, he was styling himself as a kind of intimidator. And, you know, I think this is a kind of scenario that a lot of us don't necessarily associate with the Patriot movement, of kind of a thuggish vigilanteism that was, you know, and yet on the other side was really trying to control what was going on the streets of Boston.
The kind of visceral sense of that vigilanteism comes through in a story you tell about a man named John Malcolm. He's a 50-year-old customs officer. He's an arrogant guy. He's impulsive and he's obnoxious. But what they do to him, this mob, is really brutal. Tell that story.
Yeah, well, you know, I think a lot of us think of tar and feathering as almost kind of a comical thing, yeah. You know, where it's you know, you tar and feather them and laugh and then move on. And actually, when you get into what tar and feathering involved, it was pretty horrendous. And John Malcolm was a loyalist, a customs inspector, not a nice guy. He enjoyed baiting patriots and just was not a great fellow and gets into an argument with a patriot, knocks him on the head with his cane. A mob gathers around his house. He's there with his wife and children, and it's clear that this is not a good situation. Yeah. But he goes ahead and, you know, says some outrageous things to some patriots, and soon they're pounding down his windows, and he's dragged from his house. And it's the coldest night of the winter in January of 1774. You know, Boston Harbor is frozen over. There's snow on the streets of Boston, and he is dragged into the center of town where a few years earlier the Boston Massacre had occurred. Mm-hmm. And there's a bonfire, and using that fire, they heat up some pine tar. It's swabbed over his naked body, and then the down from a pillow is scattered all over him, and you know, his flesh is effectively parboiled by the tar. And for the next 5 hours, he's dragged through the streets of Boston, being beaten up and whipped periodically, and forced to disavow the king and the governor. And eventually dumped back in his house. And after this ordeal, he is 6 weeks in bed. The flesh comes off his back in what are described as stakes, but he survives. But this was just the kind of outbreak of uncontrolled violence that the people behind the Tea Party and Joyce Jr. were trying to control. And it put Joyce Jr. in a very terrible position. Soon after, he issued another broadside saying, although I am the president of the Tar and Feathering Committee, I had nothing to do with this, and we do not approve of this. And it just shows you that, once again, there were passions in Boston that were beyond anyone's control.
Well, they beat him within an inch of his life, as you say. They threaten to hang him at some point. He figures he's going to die. You can only imagine how terrified he is, even though he is an obnoxious character. The story kind of paints this complicated portrait of the Patriots. You know, they were principled. They were determined to be free, but they could also act like, you know, like louts from time to time, especially if you didn't agree with them or get on their side.
Yeah, I mean, it was a fact of the revolution. And yeah. The irony is that the loyalists, and later when a new royal governor, who Thomas Gage, a general, comes in and begins to clamp things down, he upholds the English liberties of the Patriots. He doesn't, no martial law. He lets them do pretty much as they please. But the Patriots in the towns beyond Boston are doing terrible things to the loyalists. And so the revolution happens basically, in part because the English were unwilling to, provide that same kind of vigilante insistence on you do it my way or the highway that the Patriots were using.
Nathaniel Philbrick is our guest. He is an historian and an author. His book is called Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. We need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the historian Nathaniel Philbrick. We're talking about his latest book. It's called Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. Philbrick, we've had him on the show before. He's written an acclaimed book about the sinking of the whale ship Essex, the inspiration for Moby Dick. That book was called In the Heart of the Sea, won the National Book Award. He also wrote the book Mayflower, which was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Well, the book is full of great characters, complicated ones, dynamic, charismatic characters. You mentioned Thomas Gage. Let's talk about Thomas Gage, this British general. He's interesting because in some ways his personal life sort of reveals the sense of conflict. He's married an American woman. And you write about how General Gage had to really deal with something that seemed like a unique problem, which was the appeal of America. I mean, some of his soldiers were deserting. So we had to sort of deal with the appeal of the liberty that was in this new world.
Yeah, Gage, I think, personifies the issues that Great Britain would have in dealing with a revolution. Gage had spent the last 17 years in America, married, as you said, to an American wife from New Jersey. And he had great sympathy for these people, but also great irritation when it was his responsibility to institute the Boston Port Act in May and June of 1774. And, he had, along with all the other officers and officials in Great Britain, had assumed that, you know, once you shut down Boston as a port and brought in some British troops and quelled the defiance that was happening in Boston, it would all calm down. Unfortunately, from his perspective, he and everyone else misjudged the fact that Boston wasn't the only place where people were objecting to Britain's very almost overreaction to the Boston Tea Party, where about 100 people had been involved in it, and they had condemned an entire city and shut it down as a port, and then would soon follow with the Massachusetts Government Act, which really made the government something, an extension of Great Britain rather than a reflection of the colony as it had always been, and Gage was someone who, by temperament, was a very understanding kind of person, not a typical hot-headed warrior, and he was conflicted from the beginning, as would all his officers be, because these were the people of Boston and Massachusetts and New England and throughout the colonies were members of the British Empire, and so they were it was something internal that was going on, and so it they were frustrated when the Patriots were very willing to not really listen to the terms of the that were being insisted upon them and rebelling in more and more heated terms. But for Gage and just about everyone who would follow him, there was very little will to make them submit in a way, because they were in a sense fighting a portion of themselves.
Mm. Gage is interesting too, because you know he clearly doesn't want to be there. He doesn't want to go back to America. I mean, he has this beautiful ancestral country estate. So he's reluctant to be there in the first place. He feels conflicted about it all. It's interesting. You also write, he writes this letter to his wife. She had left by then, but he writes it to her back in England where she was at the time, blaming her in some way for all of this.
Yeah. Well, you know, once again, these are all people. Yeah. And being in the vortex of history doesn't necessarily mean that all you think about are, you know, issues that we associate with history, whether it's great sweeping social movements or, you know, the sovereignty of parliament versus the natural rights of man. No, he's there and he's angry because one of the reasons why he agreed to come back to America was that his American wife was missing home.
Right.
And they had a new child and she wanted her relatives in New Jersey to see the new child. And so here he is, he's back in this impossible situation in Boston, and it's his wife's fault. And so there is this amazing letter in which, you know, he basically whines saying, yeah, you know, why did I listen to you? You know, this is impossible over here. They're running circles around me. No one gets it back home. There's just no way I'm going to get out of this in a way that will be good for my career. Why did you make me do this? And, you know, that's the way the past was lived, very much the way it is today, where we're, you know, what we do and how we respond to issues is a complex haze of factors, many of them personal, many of them larger than us, but they all add up to behaviors that I think we can relate to in all sorts of levels.
Mm. So we have this on one hand, Thomas Gage, a British leader. On the other hand, we have, among others, Dr. Joseph Warren. At what point did you realize that Joseph Warren was going to become the focus of the book? Because it seems like that's what happened.
Yeah, you know, actually pretty late in the process. Huh. From the beginning, I wanted this book to be about the city of Boston,
yeah,
a community experiencing the trauma of a revolution. And I sort of had inklings that this would be a different cast of characters, that John Adams, Samuel Adams, and John Hancock, who tended to be away at the Continental Congress when anything of significance was occurring in New England, that there would be a different cast of characters. And I knew of Joseph Warren. In fact, he appears in Johnny Tremaine. But I didn't really appreciate the level of importance he had to the on-the-ground revolution in Massachusetts. You know, we all know the name Paul Revere, but so few of us know who was the guy who gave Paul Revere the orders to alert the countryside that the British were coming.
Right.
It was this 33-year-old doctor named Joseph Warren. And with Samuel Adams away, Joseph Warren, a 33-year-old doctor, a widower with four children between the ages of 2 and 8,
mm-hmm,
he had really learned the craft of statesmanship from Samuel Adams, was extremely eloquent, a very good writer, but he was also much younger, and he had a kind of a charismatic, swashbuckling aspect to him. He was the kind of guy, if two people were arguing in a room, he'd come in, talk with both of them, and by the end, everyone would agree with him, even though it had nothing to do with the issue, what
right,
they thought believed beforehand. And so Joseph Warren really becomes the leading patriot personage in Boston. He's the one who really pulls the plug that initiates Lexington and Concord. He's the one who creates a provincial army with the help of all the other generals. And, mm-hmm, and if he hadn't died at the Battle of Bunker Hill, I think he very well could have been one of the founding fathers we venerate today. But he died, and George Washington appears, and so the pantheon does not include Joseph Warren.
Doesn't that bother you? I mean, he's an amazing. I mean, the stories you tell about his life, like his unusual household, his practice, the people that he would see, that he was a spendthrift. I mean, he wasn't just cloaked in. In great garb. I mean, he could be a spendthrift. He spent too much money from time to time. When he was in medical school, he and a group of people would steal these corpses to dissect the bodies. I mean, he's a really interesting character, crucial player. And let's be honest, hardly anyone knows who he is.
Right. I mean, this was he was a leader with a difference. For example, there was every March 5th, there was a Massacre Day oration after the Boston Massacre. Oration Day of 1775, this is just, basically a month before the Lexington and Concord, is this emotionally freighted event where 5,000 people crowd into the Old South Meeting, the same place where the meeting had been prior to the Boston Tea Party. And Warren delivers his oration dressed in a Roman toga. And, there's a theatrical aspect to him that is interesting. But he was also quite a deep thinker. And the letters he writes to Samuel Adams, who's away at the Continental Congress, talk about the most vital and primary of issues of governance and he's doing it before it's even happening in Continental Congress. Yeah, he's an extraordinary person. And I have to say, in his behalf, I was going, why don't we know about this guy? Yeah. And it just shows you how history works. He was cut off young, at 34 when he died, and so he didn't have the paper trail that someone like John Adams, who would keep a diary all his life and write countless letters, you wouldn't have that kind of level of documentation to tell the story. And so for me, it was kind of like, okay, so this is a guy we don't know about, but boy, what an impact he had. And in many ways, what happened at Lexington and Concord would not have happened if all the effort he put into organizing the provincial government hadn't been in place. Mm.
Before we head to a break, let me mention two other great characters that I loved. They're not as crucial as Warren, maybe, but Lieutenant Colonel Charles Lee is great. Described as uncouth and eccentric, kind of impulsive, but really smart. And Israel Putnam, another colonel, arrives with a herd of sheep in the story for the town's poor. Really interesting characters, too.
Yeah, and they were almost mythic when it came to the imaginations of the people of Boston. Charles Lee was a former British officer who was clearly putting his hat in the Patriot ring. Mm-hmm. And so he was an odd duck. He had a pack of dogs that followed him wherever he went. He loved spouting outrageous statements. And then you have Putnam, this rotund veteran of the French and Indian War, who was just the kind of person the people of Boston loved.
Nathaniel Philbrick is with us. His book is called Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. We'll get to that battle when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the historian Nathaniel Philbrick. We're talking about his new book, Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. I wanted to, let's talk about the battle itself. The battle, it began as a mistake. It was a mistake.
Yeah. No one expected it to happen, particularly when it came to the Patriot forces. The original plan was that the Patriots had heard that the British were about to make a thrust out of Boston. By this time, Boston was surrounded by thousands of Patriot militiamen, and the British Army decided that what they needed to do was deliver a knockout blow to those soldiers and send them reeling. And in order to postpone that, if not stop it altogether, the Patriots decided to build a fort on Bunker Hill, the highest hill on the Charlestown Peninsula, just across the Boston Harbor from Boston. And it was supposed to be it was a nighttime operation.
Right.
And instead of building this earthen redoubt, which was a roofless fort made out of just dirt, instead of building it on Bunker Hill, which would have been a defensive measure, which would have prevented the British from attacking the armies centered in Cambridge, for reasons that are still unclear today, the fort was built on Breed's Hill, yeah, a smaller hill much closer to the British in Boston, putting him literally in the face of the British. And so when dawn arrived on June 17, 1775, and General Gage looked across Boston Harbor at this fort within a cannon shot of his forces, he said, "I've got to attack."
Yeah.
And so and immediately all the British warships that were around Charlestown Peninsula start firing on the redoubt. And the Patriot leaders go, "Oh my goodness, instead of stop, you know, by having this fort built in an unexpected location, we're going to have a battle on our hands rather than postponing an attack." And so from the beginning, the Battle of Bunker Hill began in confusion.
I mean, I'm trying to imagine. So the Patriots are digging in now. I mean, this fort exposed them, so they had to start digging and building. These cannonballs are whizzing by. That's an amazing story, and you tell the story. I think it's William Prescott who is too, you know, he has to get his soldiers to remain calm despite the fact that they're not really in the greatest defensive position. I mean, it's a really amazing story.
Well, you know, when dawn comes and his soldiers see for the first time where they actually are, because up until this point it's been so dark they don't know where they are.
Yeah.
And they see that, oh my goodness, we're right in the middle of this. This is not a good place to be. And what Prescott realized immediately was that if the British Army was to land to his left on the tip of the Charlestown Peninsula, they would have a wide open approach to his fort. And so immediately he began to dig in to his left. Eventually, fortifications, very hastily constructed fortifications, would be built all the way to the Mystic River on the eastern side of the Charlestown Peninsula. And his men were farmers. Most of them had no battle experience whatsoever. And yet cannonballs were sizzling out of the sky, landing all around them. On just the third or fourth shot, one of his men, Asa Pollard, had his head taken off by a cannonball. And so he to rally his men in the face of this overwhelming and terrifying prospect of being attacked by the British Army, he jumps onto the parapet of his fort and takes the hat off his head, waves it around, and bids defiance to the British. You know, "Come on and attack me. I dare you." And by many accounts, it would be William Prescott's example of incredible bravery against overwhelming odds that kept his men from, instead of fleeing in panic, holding their ground and repelling not one, not two, but three British charges up the green hills of the Charlestown Peninsula.
Did he really say, "Hold your fire till we see the whites of their eyes"?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There is no documentation definitively tying that phrase to an officer at the Battle of Bunker Hill. It could have easily been said. That phrase had been used beforehand and would be used afterwards. It was kind of a common way of describing, wait, don't shoot too early, wait till they're very close. The one thing we do know an officer said came from Colonel Stark,
who
was a New Hampshire officer, who advised his men not to fire until they saw the whites of the splash guards on the officers' feet, which are known as half gaiters. But you know, I don't think the term "don't fire till you see the whites of their half gaiters" has quite the ring
right.
of the phrase we all know.
That John Stark story is a great one. I mean, he orders his men to build a stone wall.
Yeah. Well, he's the one who really saved the battle for the Patriots. He arrives very late. Already, General Howe, who was leading the British forces on the Charlestown Peninsula, was ready to go. They were about to attack, and he arrives very late and sees that the fortifications that have been dug in by the Patriots are fine and good, but there is an Achilles heel to it, that there along the edge of the Mystic River is a beach just below a bank, and the fortifications stop at the bank. They're leaving the beach open. And wouldn't you know, Howe's plan was to send his elite forces, the Welsh Fusiliers, along that beach, get them behind the Patriot lines and attack them in flank. And Stark sends his New Hampshire boys down onto the beach. They collect the stones and create this barrier so that when the Welsh Fusiliers in the very early stages of the battle arrive, instead of an open door, they run into a stone wall. And in the minutes that followed, an estimated 100 British soldiers would die at that stone wall as they attempted to punch through. They couldn't. They would eventually retreat, and it would be left to other portions of the army to finally take the redoubt on Breed's Hill.
You know, I'm going to think about that story every time I go to New Hampshire and see those stone walls. A nice way to kind of connect to that, because they build their share of stone walls in that part of the country.
Well, you know, the farmers of New England are, you know, known as rock farmers.
Yeah.
And it was not the soil of the South where you could, you know, have staple crops like tobacco. They were, you know, it was very different in New England. And I think, you know, those stones are a very good, you know, embodiment of what the New England flinty character was all about.
You include in the book some illustrations. Among them, there's this engraving by the illustrator Howard Pyle of people in Boston watching the fight from their rooftops, looking at the Battle of Bunker Hill. And in fact, you really begin the story with the story of John Quincy Adams, who's 7 years old. He was one of them watching this play out.
Yeah, I mean, it was a terrifying and exceedingly traumatic spectator event. The thousands of Bostonians, as you just said, were on the roofs of their houses watching as 2,000 British regulars were rowed across the harbor and then marched up towards Breed's Hill. And there were John Quincy Adams, as a 7-year-old, was watching from his home in Braintree, more than 10 miles away. People on the hills of Cambridge were also watching. You know, much as we will sometimes see a terrifying event from our TVs, you know, they were watching this unfold. And that we have these accounts of people who were there, including British General John Burgoyne. He was one of the more arrogant British officers, and that's saying something. He has this letter in which he describes the state of mind they had watching this, knowing that the fate of the English-speaking world might be determined by what was about to unfold on the Charlestown Peninsula. And so you have a whole community sharing, watching, with the tensions all crackling in the atmosphere as they watch it all unfold.
You know, George Washington's response to all of this. Of course, the British win the battle, but in the end, they realize that it's going to be an immensely costly thing. I mean, this was, I guess, in some ways, you could see this as a win for the colonies. In that sense, they realized that it was going to cost a lot to try to maintain their hold on the colonies. And George Washington's response, I think, is interesting too. And I have to say, in some ways, a little disappointing. I mean, he writes this letter to his cousin where he describes the New Englanders as exceedingly dirty and a nasty people, said they were stupid, a lower class of people. But this is such a crucial moment because you write about how really, I mean, the New Englanders for George Washington, they're a different culture. You know, he's a genteel Virginia farmer, but he's got to find a way to forge these different cultures if the revolution is really going to succeed. And this seems really crucial.
Well, I think you have to credit Washington with the difficult work of creating a new nation.
Yeah.
He was confronted with a culture clash. He's from Virginia, hierarchical society, where people know their place.
Yeah.
New England, it's different. Yeah. Thanks to the town meeting, they're used to operating by consensus. And as a consequence, when a New England officer tells his men to do something, they say, whoa, wait a minute.
Yeah.
We have to discuss this and approve it before we do it. And this drove Washington crazy. You know, he's trying to create a professional army. And so he does describe in despair and anger the men he's forced to deal with, but he doesn't give up on them.
Right.
It devolves into a siege of nearly a year, and what he begins to do is gradually drag New England from a very parochial approach. You know, they just saw themselves as almost in an almost tribal kind of manner. Makes them realize, wait, it's not just about New England being New England. It's about New England, Virginia, and all the colonies beginning to think not as a nation. And so with the creation of what will become the Continental Army, and it wasn't pretty, it didn't go beautifully in the beginning, certainly, Washington, through his patience and a character that, he even when things went wrong, he was able to rebound in a way that most men, I don't think, would have been able to. But through this process of trying to make people think outside their own box and think in terms of a new one, he lays the groundwork that, with the common sense from Tom Paine, will lead to the thrust towards independence.
Mm. Less than a minute, let me ask you this finally. I know it makes no sense to ask these what-if questions sometimes, but I wonder if, would something have lit the powder keg of rebellion at some point if Bunker Hill hadn't happened? I mean, wouldn't something else have happened somewhere else? Or was, in some way, was Boston uniquely possessed with this kind of attitude to get it started?
Well, a little bit of both.
Yeah.
The what-ifs of history are tantalizing. It's what has become increasingly clear to me with each book I write is it could have gone so many different ways.
Right.
We like to see the past as inevitable because obviously we're the result of all those events. But when you're in the midst of it, it's anything but inevitable. We'll never know. But, you know, clearly the passions of the revolution were going to be unleashed one way or another.
Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of Bunker Hill, A City, A Siege, A Revolution. Joined us today from the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket Island off the coast of Massachusetts. And Nathaniel Philbrick, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.